So I'd like to introduce Connor Russomano. He's the co-founder from OpenBCI, and he's helped develop the OpenBCI 8-bit, 16-bit, or 8-channel, 16-channel, and 4-channel OpenBCI devices. They're open source hardware, and he works on a lot of open source projects. He's on the podcast now. Connor, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, John.
So let's give us an introduction of like who you are, where you're from, and how you became the co-founder of OpenBCI.
Sure. So as John said, my name is Connor. I'm co-founder and CEO of OpenBCI. I did back in the day, I did an undergraduate degree in what started as a mechanical engineering degree, switched to civil engineering, and I did an informal minor in computer graphics, and this was all at Columbia University in New York. And then immediately after graduating, I went to Parsons School of Design to study design and technology in an MFA program. And I didn't know anything about brain-computer interfacing or EEG prior to going to grad school. And then while I was in my physical computing class in my first semester of the two-year program, I was taking the course with Joel Murphy, who's now my OpenBCI co-founder, and I discovered a online tutorial of how to hack toy EEGs, and it was basically love at first sight. In the matter of a day, I followed this tutorial and hacked into a low-cost toy called the MindFlex, streamed the data through an Arduino to a processing sketch on my computer, and I was looking at my brain data for the first time. And that was kind of the beginning of the end. That was the moment I tasted the BCI Kool-Aid.
That's awesome.
And then, I jumped forward 4.5 years, and now here I am talking to you on the podcast.
Nice.
I mean, obviously a lot happened between now and then, but
yeah,
that was kind of the beginning.
I remember that. That was I don't remember your story, but I remember my first EEG hack was also that the MindFlex and Arduino with the processing sketch and seeing my brainwaves in real
time.
Yeah,
I still consider that the greatest hack of all time.
Yeah, it really is. You pop a hole in it, you solder two wires out to your Arduino, and then grab their script from GitHub. It's simple, it's clean, and it has great results.
Yeah.
So, can you tell us a little bit more about what EEG is? What's it measuring? What's an EEG device, and how does it measure the brainwaves?
Sure. So the best analogy I like to use is that your brain, and really your entire body, but I just focusing on the brain, your brain is like an ocean of electricity. And with EEG, what we're doing is we're essentially standing on the beach with electrodes, like standing on the beach and watching waves crash on the shore. And so if you took a multimeter and you put it on opposite sides of a battery, you would see a steady voltage over time, and then it would trail off as you lost juice in your battery. But if you did the same thing to, a point on your head and your earlobe, you wouldn't see a steady voltage, you would see variable voltage. And so with EEG, what we do is we listen to those waves crashing on the beach of our scalp. We listen to the changes in voltage over time, and then we take that data, put it into a computer, and we try and make inferences. We label that data. We try and understand why certain frequencies or amplitudes of waves are the way that they are. By presenting different stimuli, looking at environmental data, things like that. So really, EEG is in a nutshell, the measurement of electrical data from the scalp and trying to infer things about the brain from that data.
Nice. And so you built one of these EEG devices from scratch, correct?
I guess you could say that, yeah. I mean, with the help of my business partner, Joel.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah. So, you, Joel, and I mean, you had resources, and Joel's your co-founder.
Yeah, of course.
So your company that you started after you took that class that inspired you to pursue this, direction.
Yep. So Yeah, so I guess you could say from scratch, but we did have the help of a lot of components. So the OpenBCI board, at least the first version of our tech, is based around the ADS-1299 chip, which is a Texas Instruments. Really, it's an EEG system on a chip. And so a lot of the analog, the ADC, the analog to digital conversion, and the lead-off detection and features of our EEG system are built into this little chip, which made our life a lot easier. And what we did is we built an Arduino wrapper for the functions of this chip and kind of put a lot of work into exposing through, accessible functions and methods and classes, the nitty-gritty, the zeros and ones of this multiplexer and this ADS-1299 chip.
Okay, and the ADS-1299 is an analog-to-digital converter. Can you elaborate a little bit more on how that's useful in measuring the brainwaves and converting them into a signal that the Arduino or whatever computer program can process?
Yeah, I mean, I love this question because it's kind of the... it's philosophical in nature in some ways, but it's essentially, it's the difference between the analog and the digital, or, the kind of the continuum and the discrete. So, our environment, the real world is analog. Electrical values are not measured on a discrete scale. There's a continuum. But in order for a computer, which is based on a binary or a Boolean system, to comprehend environmental electricity, it has to somehow translate an analog signal into a digital signal. And that's so that it can be represented in zeros and ones or in a discrete form. An ADC is essentially the tool that does that. It takes some analog electrical value from the real world and maps it into a discrete range that is represented in bits. And so in our case, the ADS-1299 has a built-in ADC that each channel has a 24-bit resolution, meaning the voltage range is measured onto a resolution of 2 to the 24th power. And so it's, that's a big number in the millions. And so we're measuring, a range of negative 2.5 to 2.5 volts that is broken into, subcomponents or discrete levels or steps, over a million discrete steps.
So it's pretty high resolution.
Yeah, high resolution. And, and that's not unique to our system. Most EEG systems are somewhere between, 16-bit and 32-bit.
Okay, and so one of the things I'm interested in startups in general is their origin story. So, after you and Joel talked and decided you wanted to collaborate on a project to make a EEG device, what were your next steps? What followed from that? How did you get from an idea in your guys' head to an actual physical product?
Sure. So the real origin story, I guess the way that we started was around the time, or actually prior to when I graduated from Parsons. I had been working with commercial EEG systems like Emotive and NeuroSky, and I had been exploring the open EEG electrodes and things like that. And Joel had built the pulse sensor, which is an open hardware optical heart rate monitor for Arduino. So he had already, started his career in the open hardware and the open source biosensing. And he got approached on a DARPA subcontract opportunity to help build a low-cost EEG device for non-traditional users. So DARPA put out a solicitation to build this, and then a company, Criari, won part of the phase one contract. Criari ended up subcontracting Joel to help out with the hardware design, and then Joel ended up subcontracting me to get involved with, some of the firmware development and writing the code to hack into the ADS-1299 with Arduino, if you will. And then, you know, I spent a few weeks over the summer helping him write the firmware, and then Joel finished, Joel did the majority of the hardware design. And then we took the initial design to Maker Faire with all of the other subcontractors and contractors of the DARPA grant. So we were there with an individual named Bill Casebeer, who was the program manager at DARPA at the time. And actually, I think a few other groups were there as well. I think Cognionics was there. And I don't remember who else was there, but essentially we were all there showing off our stuff. And the Maker Faire attendees really loved the first prototype of the OpenBCI board, which was a shield for Arduino. And so we compiled a huge list of emails at the Maker Faire. And that was like the moment when we realized we should kickstart this thing, regardless of whether or not Criari ended up getting phase two. And so that was the moment Joel and I partnered up formally to form the business, OpenBCI. And that's when it went from hardware, from a hardware prototype to a business. Mm-hmm. And then we launched our first Kickstarter campaign. And that was kind of the real kickstart, if you will, of the company.
And that Kickstarter campaign was launched in 2013, 2012?
It was December something, maybe December 3rd of 2013 was when we launched the Kickstarter.
And it's a safe bet you guys made your goal. Like you reached your goal from Kickstarter?
We did. Our target was 100,000 and we raised 215,000. So we more than doubled our target. And that was great. It gave us, like all Kickstarters, you run into unforeseen obstacles and hurdles and hoops that you have to jump through. And it was a really good thing that we made that extra money because it was difficult. It was not an easy project. And yeah. I think we survived, but there were definitely hard points.
Yeah, I think I remember you guys had manufacturing problems from China. Was it just customs problems, or was it also like the manufacturing
process? It was a number of things.
Yeah, so you guys...
we had, on 400 of our units, we had a diode that was soldered on backwards, so we had to do, and when I say we, I really mean Joel and our friend Leaf, did a lot of manual work on a bunch of our units to reverse diodes. But that was, we don't even know where that error, probably a communication error between us and China. But, that was just one of many obstacles that we ran into, including like unforeseen shipping costs and, kitting and orchestrating the process of, fulfillment, which is just an art, fulfillment is, especially for a Kickstarter campaign where you've got close to 1,000 backers, it can be a lot to manage.
So another thing that intrigues me about your guys's like origin story and how you all got started was you chose to open source the hardware and mm-hmm. To me, that was new, like a company that would contribute and develop, put all this work into their project and release everything openly accessible and available via GitHub. Like, and that's part of your name, right? OpenBCI, Open Brain Computer Interface. And you have the stamp on your hardware device that says open source hardware. Like, what were the decisions you guys made to come to that conclusion to open source everything?
I think Joel and I are both strong proponents of the open source model for a number of reasons. I learned everything that I know about what I do and EEG and interfacing the brain through online tutorials and videos and guides that that were open source. And so I want to pay homage and tribute to the origins of my knowledge base. And I think Joel has a similar perspective on all of the things, you know, all of the knowledge that he has for electronics and PCB design and whatnot. But it, you know, from a bigger perspective, you know, we are, you know, we're trying to set an example and show that there are, you know, that open source is viable in a commercial sense. But also, you know, with a technology like interfacing the brain, it's important to think about the social impact that you're making as a company. You know, there's no, you know, there's no denying that BCI and EEG and whether, you know, both invasive and non-invasive brain-computer interfacing are going to be a huge part of human evolution and the future of humanity. And so we have to be very conscious about the way that this technology introduces itself into the world. And open source is just a great way of, you know, I think that open source is a great way of pulling from the front while pushing from the back. You know, if you can make your technology accessible, not only do you encourage a community of inspired people to help you improve what you're making, but you also you enable the technology to be accessible by anybody. You know, so a lot of people who fear the future fear the future of technology, their argument is that, you know, this technology will only be accessible to the elites. It will only be accessible to people with a lot of money. And I think that open source technology is the antithesis of that. It is, you know, it is demonstrating that, like, we can make a huge impact on this space of neuroscience and neuroengineering, while ensuring that this technology is accessible to everyone, and also anyone can learn about this. You know, no one has exclusive rights to the software or the knowledge that we are creating and disseminating.
Right, and you know, one of the experiences I've had just with the software that OpenBCI has produced and the hardware that they produced is, there is a strong community. Early on, even, I remember using the OpenBCI in the Neurogaming Hackathon in 2014. That's when I first met you. And Chip Audette, the guy that writes the EEG Hacker blog, had just wonderful tutorials on all these different components of the OpenBCI Arduino Shield, you know, the V2 or whatever version it was. And it just made my life so much easier, being a new person in this field, trying to figure out how to measure my brain waves with this device, where to put the electrodes, where to put the ground, where to put the reference, what those even meant, you know, and his blog is wonderful. I'll have to put it in the show notes because it has detailed instructions for everything and wonderful graphics, you know, describing his results. And
just the man.
Yeah,
there's no denying that.
And he was a supporter early on, right? Like, I don't know when you guys met him or how he was introduced to OpenBCI, but he's an incredible asset
Chip,
to the community.
Chip was the point man at Criari.
Oh,
so okay. He was the individual that reached out to Joel initially to get him on board with the DARPA contract. So even though Criari did not win phase two of the DARPA solicitation, Chip stayed on board and just, you know, loved the notion of the project and the whole idea of open source brain computer interfacing, and ended up, and he's still in the history of our community page, the most active contributor to our community, at least in terms of tutorials and guides. So Chip is at the soul. He is right there in the heart of OpenBCI for sure.
Yeah. And you know, that's one thing about the device you guys have and sell and make is you also curate a community, and this community is growing, not just for OpenBCI, but for you know, EEG devices in general, but extending to other realms. Like one thing you even did was control a 3D printed arm with the OpenBCI device. And with no outside software, it was all the code was flashed onto the OpenBCI firmware, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
we got that half working at a hackathon, and then the progress on that kind of tailed off once the hackathon was over. But
I mean, the proof of concept still exists. Like, it's this device measures more than just brainwaves. You know, measures. It's very sensitive. It can measure EMG. It can possibly like showcase eye movement or, you know, facial expressions if you have the right algorithms. Like, what other projects have you seen people use the OpenBCI before that wasn't just measuring and visualizing brainwaves?
I think EMG, myoelectric data, so data from the muscles, is just as exciting and interesting as brain data. We've demonstrated the ability to tap into muscles in the forearm, muscles in the bicep, muscles in really any muscle group, including the face and the head and the jaw and things like that, and being able to harness this data to control things or as an input. You know, and the great thing about muscle data is that it is so predictable and easy to detect because the amplitude of the signal is much higher. We spend our whole life training our muscles to work the way that we expect them to. And so it's just a great way to get bio data relative to brain activity, which is a much harder signal to capture and train. And so I'm actually a huge proponent of using what works. And I think, you know, as people get excited about BCI, I think that they're often enticed by article titles and phrases like, you know, mind-controlled drone or brain-controlled robot or things like that. When in reality, I think EEG is much more interesting for things beyond interactivity. And I think muscle signals are very practical for interactivity, even in groups like people with ALS or quadriplegics. It's way easier to tap into a muscle signal or signature from the face or the head or the scalp than it is to classify a brainwave. And so I think when we're thinking about helping people, you know, if the number one design constraint is helping a population, we should be looking at EMG signals to help people with ALS before we should be looking at classifying brain data. I think that EMG will be scaled much more easily than brain data. Mm. That said, I think that should not prevent us from researching EEG and its practical effects and applications. I think that EEG data is still very valuable for looking at interest, shifts in overall brain state, contextualizing the way that we interact with our real world. So looking at event-related potentials and trying to identify when our mind is in kind of a mind-wandering state versus in an engaged state and contextualizing that or like labeling that against, you know, what it is that we're interacting with. But yeah, getting back to your question, sorry, I kind of went off on a tangent there. The OpenBCI platform is really just a general purpose biosensing tool. So it can measure brain data, heart data, muscle data, and accelerometer data, so body movement as well.
Yeah, that leads me to the next question. Like, when you buy an OpenBCI device from your website, what comes in the box? What do people get, and what can they use that for immediately? Like, right out of the box.
Right out of the box. So, I mean, if you get the electrodes too, it kind of depends on the OpenBCI store has a lot of accessories and bells and whistles and things like that you can tack on. But, you know, if you get the complete system, which is an Ultra Cortex, a 32-bit board, or, you know, in 6 months when we're shipping the ganglion boards, the things that you can definitely do are plug in the system, download the app. We now have a standalone app. You don't have to run the code from processing. You can just run the OpenBCI GUI as a standalone app on Mac, Linux, or Windows. You can see your brain data. You can blink your eyes, grit your teeth. You can see the EMG artifacts. You can record that data, and you have it in a text file. And that's kind of the bare bones. But what we're really trying to do is empower creators, makers, engineers, neuroscientists who want to build on top of what of the tools that we've created. And so we have a really extensive and quickly growing API suite of SDKs and APIs, if you will. So like our GitHub has a Node.js that was just added by one of our best community developers at the moment, AJ. But we also have a Python repository. We have the processing code, which is based in Java. So all of this code is open source, and you can dig down into the nitty-gritty, and you can rewrite it, expand it, destroy it, whatever. So it's really intended for the makers and the developers of the neurohacking space.
That's great, because there's, you know, like, people, that means people can choose their own headsets, they can, you know, they can make their own headsets, they can choose their own electrodes. There's a whole variety of things that you can, you know, use when you're measuring brain waves or other bio, you know, electro bio signals. That's mm-hmm. awesome that you guys give people the freedom. You don't constrain them to X number of electrodes of type Y. You know, it can be dry electrodes, it can be wet electrodes, it can be active electrodes. I really appreciate that fact about OpenBCI, that characteristic, that it's kind of, well, you get to build
I think the trade-off, you know, like, I don't want to take anything away from kind of our commercial counterparts in the space. The trade-off is that, you know, when you're working with OpenBCI, you're working with a tool. It's not a commercial experience. It's an experience intended for developers and makers, like people who want to get into the nitty-gritty, understand what's going on, learn, and also, you know, develop. So it's, you know, I guess the only real commercial experience is for research. We don't have a lot of applications, out-of-the-box experience applications that come with the OpenBCI tool. The tool is a platform to use for development.
Mm-hmm. Which I think at this stage of the whole ecosystem, it's not like many people are going to Best Buy to buy an EEG device to strap onto their kids to make them do their homework better. You know, something like that, where like they want to improve their meditation, or it's not like a Fitbit or something like that. You know, it's people are, there's still a lot of research going on, and there's a lot of people in the community interested in just doing research. So, you know, we're both part of the NeuroTechX community, which is kind of like a bunch of people interested in this area of development. BCI devices.
Neuro-nerds.
Yeah, neuro nerds, right? Geeks and researchers, and just the communities kind of coalesce into this group, NeuroTechX. And, you know, it's great to have a bunch of people you can talk to and ask for help, or ask them to know what their experiences are with different platforms and different hardware, different software, and what the whole tech stack is, because it's, you know, it's not like just you're building a simple web application anymore. You're interfacing with the body, and that has its own set of complexities that just gets put onto the table. And what has your experience been with the NeuroTechX community? I mean, it started less than a year ago. It's growing. It's international. It's getting big, it seems.
I love it. I love everything that it stands for. To be honest, it's something that I wanted to do with OpenBCI, but we just didn't have the internal resources to be effective community managers. And so I'm really happy that, the individuals in Montreal who really kind of took charge, Yannick and Melanie and Sydney, and then also you and Marion in San Francisco, it's amazing that it's happening. And I think it's just like, it's a natural part of the growth of the BCI industry. And I think it's exactly what the industry needs, is kind of this clearinghouse, this central meeting place to have conversations, talk about different opportunities, strategize how best to connect you know, various hardware and software tools in the space. I think it's amazing. And if you're listening to this podcast and you don't know about Neurotech X, you should definitely go check it out and join the Slack, because some of the most interesting conversations in the neurotech industry are happening there.
Yeah, I've definitely witnessed some great talks on the EEG data channel where I was just mind blown. Like every time someone replies to something, there's just, you know, there's one guy, oh, I forget his name, it's Alexander or something, who won a Kaggle competition on it, and on motor imagery analysis. And he was explaining to this other guy, Octavian, about the algorithm he used and what his, you know, tech stack was to accomplish that. Like, all the GPUs he had working in tandem, in parallel with each other, to process all of this data. And it was just an amazing conversation to have, and like, not even to be a part of, but just to witness, you know, because I think people
it's amazing that it's happening in a public forum.
Yeah,
and it's great.
And it's really nice to have. And you, or OpenBCI itself, has their own community page, right? I mean, it's not just Neurotech X where contributions, like a lot of contributions are being made directly onto OpenBCI.
Yeah, I mean, the OpenBCI community page has kind of been it hasn't been our highest priority, but it's been a side project for a long time. And we're actually, we're just now really thinking about kicking it into gear and actually being proactive about bringing in custom content. And so what we've done is we've noticed blogs and websites in the world that are publishing content, either working with OpenBCI or related to OpenBCI. And then what we do is we grab those RSS feeds and assign them to members in our community. It's essentially a shared WordPress. Mm-hmm. And so we now have content automatically coming into our feed. And we're also considering the prospect of paying people in our community to put custom content up there that follows certain guidelines. You know, like, this is a tutorial that implements OpenBCI. There's a GitHub repo that's well documented. It has a README. If you're interested in doing that, feel free to reach out to me. You can contact me on Neurotech X through the Slack channel. I'm there, so if you send me a direct message on that, I'll receive it. We're doing that, and we'll probably make a public announcement about that in Neurotech X, about, you know, opportunities to actually get paid to contribute to the OpenBCI community page.
That's great. I mean, that gives a lot of people there the opportunity to sustain themselves through contributing and giving back to the community. And, you know, it does take a lot of work to make a project that you can share with other people that other people can actually easily understand and follow. You know, the quality takes effort, and effort takes time.
Right, yeah.
And resources. Yeah, so that's...
It's one thing to build a project. It's another thing to tell someone else how to do it.
And yeah, step by step. And
it's the open source spirit, but a lot of times your time is valuable. And one thing we think that it's almost a natural part of an open source business model to have that trickle-down effect where we reward our community for being verbose about their creativity and the way that they're implementing the OpenBCI technology.
I mean, that's awesome that you guys are willing to contribute back like that, you know, and help grow the community. That's great. Where do you see it going? Like, where do you see EEG devices in general and other, like, more invasive brain computer interfaces possibly in the future? Like, where are we headed? When can I just control my car with my brain waves, or, you know, just by thinking about turning on my lights in my house, the lights in my house turn on, you know, the whole Internet of Things approach? How will we be able to do that? Is that in the future? Is it sci-fi? Like, what's happening with that?
I do think that someday we inevitably will be able to do that. It's just a matter of when. I'm not sure if we'll ever get there with non-invasive forms of BCI. I think there's too much noise. There's, no matter how good the electrodes get, movement and ambient electrical noise and you know, just there are so many factors that influence signal to noise ratio. And I honestly think that we'll get there with EMG based systems. That being said, I do think invasive forms of BCI are really interesting. There was a recent article about the Dr. Philip Kennedy written in Wired. He went to Belize to undergo his own surgery that he'd been performing on stroke patients and quadriplegics, but then ran into FDA resistance to start to continue working with human subjects. So he just went and did it to himself in Belize. I think there, you know, that's really ballsy for a scientist to take that leap, you know, and not need the surgery, but want to do it anyway for the sake of science. I don't think most people would be willing to do that. But, you know, there, you know, invasive BCI is a thing. It's a reality already. You know, there aren't many human subjects that have undergone invasive BCI, but it's starting to happen. We have a long way to go to figure out, you know, what the final form factor will be with invasive BCI, whether it's some, you know, microscopic robots that are floating around in the bloodstream of our brain, or you know, a more visible mechanical structure to interface the skull and the brain. You know, I think time will tell, but it's, you know, it's fascinating. And I think once we get to that point, you can start thinking about practical means of controlling things with your mind. Otherwise, let's find a different way.
So, I mean, the current state of affairs right now is, like, you can't read my thoughts. You know, right now with EEG devices and even, like, near-infrared spectroscopy, it's not like the government can come in, put it on my head. What was that?
I said, I think it kind of depends on the context of that question, because if we do get to a point where people are wearing commercial EEG systems and allowing for their data to be anonymously submitted or tracked by the companies who are facilitating, you know, the benefit, you know, or the beneficial experience of, you know, whatever benefit you're deriving from wearing a commercial EEG during an experience, a lot can be learned about you and your interests and what it is that you're engaging with and how much you're enjoying what you're looking at by your brain data. So, you know, that may not literally be reading your thoughts, but many inferences could be made about what it is that you're interacting with and how interested you are in that information.
I guess especially in conjunction with other sensor input, like if I'm browsing the web or if I have my cell phone attached and, you know, like I'm speeding down the highway and I'm getting a thrill from it, you know, or something, making dangerous decisions or gambling in Vegas or something like that. I see. So there is, and that's kind of a big data aggregation thing, right? Like that's, that takes a lot of
Users. Yeah, I mean, like if you're, not necessarily, I mean, a profile could be built about you as an individual user. So if you're wearing a consumer EEG headset and your data is being tracked in the context of where your mouse or your cursor is on a screen, you know, if you've enabled your webcam to be tracking your eyes and what you're looking at on a screen, event-related potential data or P300 data could be logged and contextualized against, you know, the things that you're interacting with, which buttons you're clicking, where you're stopping in your Facebook news feed to look at, you know, an element. And then all of a sudden, you know, you can build an interest profile or an engagement profile about an individual subject. So you know, that is not far-fetched. Mm-hmm. That is something that, if the technology was in place, could be done today.
I mean, for most of those inputs, it seems like it's already being done. Like, mouse clicks on a website, you look at even sites like LinkedIn, and they're tracking all your mouse clicks. They know where it's going, and some intrusion detection systems use a person's keystrokes to determine whether it's a machine or the actual human that belongs to that system or is associated with that system using that system, mm-hmm. you know, to see whether you've been infiltrated by some bad agent. I mean, so I guess the tech stack already exists for something like that. It's just adding, plugging that extra sensor in and figuring out the best ways to analyze it. So you mentioned ERP, event-related potential. That's where some type of stimulus happens, and then you see a change in the electrical activity X milliseconds after that stimulus?
Essentially, yeah.
So I'm familiar, I think, with the P300 speller. That's for me, the most common BCI use case for mm-hmm. like EEG devices, right? And can you explain a little bit about the P300 speller? And do you know, actually, if it's been used with the OpenBCI, if anyone's tested it out?
Yeah, I think actually Jeremy Frey, a PhD student based in France, connected the OpenBCI hardware to the OpenVibe software suite and used the complete system to build a P300 speller. So it has been done, but essentially a P300 speller, it looks for, P300 is a form of ERP or event-related potential that looks for essentially a surge of electrical activity following an expected stimuli. Mm-hmm. With a P300 speller, you've got a vertical bar and a horizontal bar that are kind of randomly crisscrossing on top of a grid of letters. And then the moment that the vertical bar and the horizontal bar connect above the letter that you're looking at and your intended, you know, the letter that you want to use, your senses perceive that this moment has happened, and you elicit this kind of excitement response, like, yep, that's the one, you got it. And that electrical, you know, signature can be detected in brain activity. And so, you know, for someone who's locked in, they can spell at a pretty slow pace, I think, you know, 6 characters per minute or something like that. But at least they're able to get the, you know, intention out of their head and into the real world.
And just to clarify, like, locked in means you're outside of a state of coma, but you still can't communicate with the outside world. You aren't just like forgot the keys to your wine cellar and, you know, accidentally got
right. Locked in is essentially the scariest reality I think that any human could experience, which is that your mind is perfectly normal other than the fact that you are unable to move a muscle.
Yeah.
So you have no means of speaking or moving, but, you know, the rest of your consciousness is intact. So it's a really sad, it's a sad state of being that, you know, more than a handful of people live with.
Mm-hmm. And this kind of technology can help those people communicate, right? I mean, that's
mm-hmm.
because they're expecting that once that cross happens and they get the letter they want or they get the option they want, that response happens regardless of whether their external body works. As long as their mind's functioning and they know the rules of the game, they know to focus on that one letter, that one option, then they'll elicit that response.
Exactly.
Whether it works. I mean, that's a powerful aspect of, you know, this kind of device. And these devices aren't, you know, as expensive as they used to be. I mean, it used to be medical grade EEG devices, the kind that you would use to measure brain waves was, what, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, and would take hours mm-hmm. to put together, like you know, it'd take 30 minutes to an hour to put the cap on your head and put all the gel on and get everything right with the 1020 system so all the electrodes were in the right place. And, you know, these are like 64, 128, like lots of channels, lots of electrode devices. And now for an 8 or 16 channel device like the OpenBCI, you can get that for less than an iPhone, which is, to me, incredible. Like that's just I can't believe I live in this time. where things like that are possible, and the applications of these things. That's, you know, I remember at the last NeuroGaming hackathon with Yannick and Octavian making that SSVEP game with the flashing lights and being able to use to measure two different brains on the same OpenBCI device. That was cool. You know, that's it's like killing two birds with one stone or something. You know, it's instead of spending $400 or $500 on one device to measure one brain, I can spend the same amount of money and measure two brains, you know? And yeah, I mean, we have to like be connected through wires, you know, to our heads into the device, so we can't just walk off and do it. But I mean, we're connected to the laptop wirelessly. We could be doing paired yoga, you know, me and Yannick or something, and see how our brains react to that. Like that's really great functionality, and you know, that's, I just think we're pretty lucky to be in this place. I don't know.
Yeah, there's no doubt there's a reason people are very excited about BCI right now, because the technology is more accessible than ever, and the implications are just so great.
Mm-hmm. So, it looks like we're running out of time, Connor. Is there anything you want to say, any call to actions, or any, you know, last remarks?
I would just say thank you, first of all, for, you know, having me on for the podcast. It's an honor, and I've always really enjoyed hanging out with you and coming out to San Francisco to kick it with the SF and the Bay Area neurohackers. And if you have managed to listen to this entire podcast and you're not currently inspired by BCI, go check out NeuroTechX and, you know, peruse the internet to see some of the amazing things that are being done with BCI. I think, you know, it's we've got a lot to accomplish and a lot of inspired and intelligent people to collaborate with. And I'm just excited about the future.
Thanks a lot, Connor.
Thank you, John.